Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week we're talking to Joel Achenbach from the Washington Post, whose book, A Hole at the Bottom of the Sea, The Race to Kill the BP Oil Gusher, was probably raced through to get it out on the anniversary, I suspect, Joel, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I worked very hard and very fast because we did feel that the anniversary was the time people might be interested in reading about this. And there are a bunch of other books that have come out about the oil spill, but mine is the only one that looks at the technological response to what happened. You know, like how did they fix this problem once they were presented with this monster?
Yeah. I was impressed by the way you managed the twin or even treble tracks between the finances and the technology and the politics. And, you know, between them, they really muddied the waters almost as much as the oil slick, didn't they?
The political environment was just a pressure cooker. It was the biggest story, as you know, of the summer. And as long as that thing was gushing, as long as the problem wasn't fixed, and any time you've looked on TV or on the internet, you'd see this plume, this ugly thing gushing oil into the Gulf of Mexico that created an almost unbearable situation for the principals involved, you know, the political folks, Obama, everyone else, and those of us in the media. We felt that this was a round the clock story. As long, you know, the plume never quit. You know, the spill was infinite, untrammeled. It was, you know, it had no boundary to it. And so what you had is you had a technological response, and wrapped around it sort of separately was this political response, and they didn't always work in perfect tandem there.
Yeah. Now, in news terms, as reporters, I remember my best example, I think, was the Balkan War. As soon as it became a three-sided war between the Bosniaks and the Croats and the Serbs, most news watchers sort of scratched their heads and gave up on it. Anything other than goody and baddie or two parties became a bit a little too complicated. So here you had BP and big oil, and then you had the government, and then you had the responses from the different agencies between the parties. And you're very balanced on this, but you're showing how BP and the Obama administration were busily trying to toss the ball to and fro between each other.
Well, it was clear who the bad guy was. The bad guy was BP, and BP knew that. The engineers in Houston at the BP headquarters were quite aware of the fact that the narrative was always going to have them as the villains, no matter what they did. And they resented that, and they didn't like that. And one thing I do in my book is, you know, I try to humanize everyone who's involved with this thing, including the people at BP who are working long hours trying to come up with solutions. And I don't sanitize what they did wrong. I mean, they clearly, it was a BP / Transocean / Halliburton mess that was made, and I go into what went wrong and the mistakes that were made and the misapprehensions and the pressure test that was misinterpreted and the haste to do things, the shortcuts. I get into all that. And I talk pretty straightforwardly about the mistakes in the response, and trying to lower a containment dome over this leak and it clogged with methane hydrates right away. In retrospect, that was clearly not going to work. The top kill, trying to kill the well with mud from the top, and BP refused to take an adequate measure of how fast that well was gushing. For whatever reason, they didn't really seem to want to know. And had they taken that measure, they would have realized that the top kill was not going to work. And that was in late May. So I'm not trying to, you know, give anyone a pass here, but at the same time, you know, these are people, and most of them, you know, Americans working really hard at trying to solve a difficult problem, and including the people in the government who are many of them embedded down there in Houston. And there, you know, everyone wants this problem solved. They want that well killed, and there's a lot of drama in that effort.
One of the clear things that emerges from your book is the lack of clarity at almost every level. To begin with, on that rig, it looked like there wasn't really the sort of a captain at the helm. I'm not talking about the you know, the nominal captain of the nominal Marshall Islands rig itself, where it was registered. But there's nobody who was tracking this all the way through who could see those signs and detect that false pressure test as a warning sign. It was so compartmentalized that nobody seemed to be pulling the big picture together.
Well, this is a complex operation that involves multiple companies and people, both back at the home office in Houston and out on this rig in the Gulf of Mexico. So at no point is there one person who can see all the different aspects of this thing, who understands all the different risks and hazards that are embedded in this. So, for example, the people in Houston, you know, were saying later after it happened, you know, why were we not fully informed about what was going on with this pressure test? But the people on the rig didn't know everything that people in Houston knew about the questionable cement slurry that had been used in the cement job. They didn't know everything about all the decisions in the well design that the BP had put in. And so what you had is there's no one who has full clarity over in any aspect of this thing. And so at the key moment, what happens is, you know, they put the cement down the well, they do a test to see if the cement job worked, they get a bad result. Rather than saying, wait a second, this is a bad result, maybe we've got hydrocarbons coming up this well, they do a redo on the test. They do a do-over on a different line. They get a good result. And as I explain in the book, it looks like the kill line, the second thing they tested, was clogged with some gunk they sent down the well as an effort to get around an environmental law. They sent the gunk down the well, because if you use it in the well, you can then dump it in the ocean. And if you don't use it in the well, you have to dispose of it as a hazardous waste. And this was a workaround, very expedient maneuver that may have thrown off the test. When they threw off the test, they now had a result that they thought was a good result. They pulled the heavy drilling mud out of the well, and that's when the well exploded.
Yeah, that was the sort of closest you got to sort of near malfeasance, that it was within the letter of the law, but certainly contrary to the spirit of the law, that was the gunk that they mixed together two different types, just to sort
of...
That no one had done before. He mixed a gallon. He mixed a sort of almost homeopathic sample in oil rig standards of a gallon each to see if they blow up or whatever.
It was pretty cockamamie. He took... I'll never forget the day when he got up and testified about this, and this was July 19th, when we heard that, wait a second, he mixed a gallon of one type of gunk with a gallon of another type of gunk and let it sit there overnight and watched it to see if it would thicken up and harden up too much. He thought that, well, it looks okay, so let's send it all down the well. And it was just one of these things that was a little cockamamie, and we don't know if it clogged the kill line and threw off the test, but that is one of the reigning theories. Certainly.
Well, clearly his experiment didn't allow for deep sea pressures, did it?
Well, I mean, I don't know what all they were thinking. I do know that drilling a well deep water is a risky operation, and that you have to make a lot of judgment calls about how are you going to design the well? How are you going to conduct the operation? When is it safe to do this or that? And at a number of key moments, decisions were made that, in hindsight, looked like a bad idea. You know, there was rarely a moment though where someone said, "Well, I think this might potentially be really risky, but let's do it anyway." I mean, the people on the rig, keep in mind, 11 of them died. These are veterans, you know. This is really a cautionary tale. I mean, some people sort of thought, well, don't blame it on the system, because that means you're trying to excuse the malfeasance of the companies. But I really do think that you have to look systemically at these kinds of technologies, because it'll help you understand why nuclear power plants can have a failure like we had in Fukushima, or why you could have a grid blackout, you know, that puts 52 million people in the dark like we had back in 2003. that complex technologies have these failure modes, and there are similarities from one technological accident to another, that I get into this, particularly at the end of my book, to talk about how this is sort of the thing we're going to see in the future as we become a more engineered planet. We're going to see these complex engineering technologies fail, and there's going to be commonalities in the way they fail. And it's not simply bad guys do stupid things. It's that, you know, you have systems in which the backup mechanisms aren't actually as far back as you think they are. And so the one bad event takes out all your backups, too.
Mm-hmm. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books. And this week I'm talking to Joel Achenbach from the Washington Post, whose book, A Hole at the Bottom of the Sea, The Race to Kill the BP Oil Gusher, is a timely reminder of all the things that many of us have probably forgotten with all of the other things that have happened since. At one point it reminded me there's an apocryphal story of the astronaut who was asked what he thought of sitting on top of one of those big rockets, and he said that it reminded him what he thought about was that this rocket had been built by 620,000 subcontractors, each of whom had put in the lowest bid.
Right, exactly. I know. I mean, this is a very good point. The oil industry is very, very rich and powerful industry. It doesn't want to have blowouts. This thing costs $40 billion for BP. BP actually came pretty close to going under last summer, and I go into that in the book about how Obama, when he supposedly, did this shakedown of BP, got $20 billion out of them, committed to a trust fund. What he really did is he threw them a lifeline. He saved BP, because the one thing that BP wanted was for Obama to go out in public and say, it's important that BP remain a strong and viable company. And Obama said exactly that. He said, it's not in anyone's interest, for them to go out of business. We want them to remain, strong and viable, because BP had, therefore, the money to clean up the Gulf and to pay the claims. I mean, if this had happened with some small little independent outfit that didn't have deep pockets, then the taxpayers would be completely on the hook for all of this. And so,
you hint upon it, but you don't sort of really, you don't have the space, it's not really the subject, but on BP's iconic nature, because it was actually founded by Winston Churchill. It was a government-owned company for most of its life, and its early job was to provide bunker fuel for the Royal Navy. One of the first industries that Margaret Thatcher privatized, which always made a joke because, of course, she said that the New York Times, your rival, always epitheted Margaret Thatcher as saying that she privatized the loss-making state industries. And, of course, she didn't. She privatized the state industries that were making bucketfuls of money, and BP was one of them at the time.
Well, it was interesting when this was all going down. The Obama administration was beating up on BP pretty harshly in its public statements, and essentially saying, we've got our boot on the neck of BP. If BP doesn't get their act together, we're going to fire them from this whole thing. BP is responsible for all this. And there was a lot of harsh rhetoric towards BP, and the folks in England said, hang on a second, our pension funds are heavily invested in BP stock. This is actually, and BP had to suspend its dividend. This was hurting people in the wallet over in England.
It's a huge part of the index on the Financial Times index. Yep. It's also, I think more than 50% of its stocks held in New York as well. So it was a mid-Atlantic collapse possibly impending.
That's right. And one thing I get into in the book a lot is this complex relationship between the government and BP. On the ground in Houston, the scientists for the government and the BP engineers had a pretty good working and fairly amicable relationship day to day. But the government had multiple layers of operation, including this group of freelance geniuses brought in by Steve Chu, the energy secretary, to be his advisors on this. And, they had their own ideas for what ought to be done. And So the government is not a monolith in this story. The government actually has these different groups, not always completely in sync. But this notion that the Obama administration has put out, that it devised the plan for capping the well. And the president himself said this just a few weeks ago. He said Steve Chu designed the cap for how that sealed the well. And that's just a total, it's not even remotely true. And Chu knows it. But, you know, the administration has tried pretty hard to craft a narrative about how it saved the day and how things would have been much worse had the administration not done what it did. Yeah. And there's an element of truth to it. They were useful, but they didn't save the day. It's just not.
Your depiction of those brought me to mind all of those 1950s science fiction movies where guys in white coats with slide rolls and thick horn-rimmed glasses were racing around getting excited about differential calculus.
It's interesting to get into the scientific mindset and the engineering mindset. The scientists, the thing that Steve Chu and others did that was really important is they said to BP, prove to us that you've thought through the implications of this. Show us your footnotes. Show us why you think this is going to work. Don't just say, we've always done it this way. You know, what are the principles involved? They demanded that BP think harder and more thoroughly about what it was doing. And I think BP responded to that. Among other things, BP hired a bunch of scientists to work on its operation. And that pressure from the government did, I think, heighten the kind of robustness of the response. It didn't speed it up, but it made BP keep on its toes more.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the other iconic piece of good enough for government work, where the Mars launch, they had one contractor working on metric and the other on imperial measures.
Oh, that's right. Well, there was a key moment when a U.S. Geological Survey scientist who no one's ever heard of, okay, who was out in Menlo Park, California, had to stay up all night long trying to do a calculation to figure out if it was safe to keep the well sealed. This is right after they sealed it on July 15th. And he was working alone, and if he couldn't come up with a calculation, they were going to reopen that well and let it gush anew. And what he kept thinking about was this Mars probe, you know, that went to Mars in 1999, I believe it was. It was a climate orbiter of some kind, and it crashed, and it crashed because someone failed to convert metric units to English standard units, and so he kept trying to, you know, do this conversion himself, you know, late at night to make sure that he didn't mess up.
This was one of the real points of clarity, which is almost impossible to believe, is that nobody knew how much oil was coming out of there, and I think you sort of near enough give BP a pass that they weren't deliberately understating it. It's just nobody had a clue that it was sort of, well, it was a factor of 10 pretty much, wasn't it? The amount that was actually coming out compared with the initial estimates.
The initial story was there was no leak. Then that was changed to, oh no, there's a leak, it's 1,000 barrels a day. And then about a week after that, they said, wait a second, it's more like 5,000 barrels a day. Now, that day, when they upped the leak to 5,000 barrels a day, is when this became a huge national story. Until then, it hadn't even been on the front page of the Washington Post. But when they said, no, it's not 1,000, it's 5,000, suddenly we realized this is going to be a big oil spill. The other thing is that when they made that announcement, they also revealed that they had found a new place at the bottom of the Gulf where the oil was leaking from, and so the system down there was a dynamic one that was changing. Now, as it turned out, 5,000 barrels a day wasn't even close to what it was really leaking. It was more like 50,000 or 60,000, and the government finally came up with an estimate that as of July 15th, it was almost certainly producing about 53,000 barrels a day, and the government said that earlier it had produced 62,000, and it had the reservoir had depleted down to the point where it was the 62,000 had gone to 53. This is all being litigated by BP, which does not agree with these numbers, but BP will acknowledge that it was a lot more than 5,000.
Yes, well, obviously they have a vested interest in and downplaying the figures now, since they have to pay per barrel, don't they?
Yes, they pay at least, I think, $1,100 per barrel, and maybe up, maybe more if they're found to be grossly negligent. So
at current rates, that's almost going to be the price of a barrel, isn't it?
Exactly. That's right. Good point. Good one. But yeah, so I mean, BP didn't really ever want to know how much was coming out, because if they could keep it fuzzy, they could let their lawyers then argue about it for the next 10 years. But that said, you couldn't tell just by looking at it. You would have had to deploy certain kinds of equipment or pressure gauges or something to get a good read on it. And it was the government's effort to add a pressure gauge to the ceiling cap that helped come up with the hard and fast number on July 15th. And BP was, you know, kind of kicking and dragging about all that stuff. So that wasn't the company's finest hour.
Mm-hmm. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and today I'm talking to Joel Achenbach about his book, A Hole at the Bottom of the Sea, The Race to Kill the BP Oil Gusher, a timely publication 1 year after the event. And yeah, I suppose one of the points about this is how are there lessons to make sure this doesn't happen again? A simplistic view is, well, no more deep sea drilling, you know, and I think anyone who thinks with the present political and economic circumstances that's viable probably believes in the tooth fairy as a means of solving the deficit. So
that's exactly right. Yeah, we're going to drill in the deep water. I mean, that just, in fact, horrible as this thing was, at no time did the Obama administration ever say that it was considering anything like a permanent ban on deep water drilling. And the reason is that that's where the oil is. We are an oil dependent society right now. That doesn't have to be true in 20 years or 30 years, but right now that's what fuels our economy. And so if we don't drill in deep water here, the oil industry is going to drill in deep water around the planet. So we could potentially stop it in the Gulf or
in the Arctic.
But it's going to cut. It's the deep water drilling. That technology is now going full bore. The industry needs to figure out ways to make it safer, not just in terms of avoiding what happened last year, but also I think investigating lots of different ways that the system might fail.
Well, one of the points that really came out with some shock in your book is the blowout preventer, which it looked incredibly intricate, but it didn't work, and it was sort of designed with strings and sealing wax. It didn't fit the blueprints. Things weren't where they should be. The shear bars were in the shear rams were in the wrong place, and no one had really tried it out before. It was really it just growed like topsy almost.
Well, they had tinkered with it and changed it around and jury rigged it in various ways, and at the crucial moment, I mean, with this crucial moment, the blind shear rams were supposed to close and cut the drill pipe and seal the well, and instead the drill pipe was buckled by the initial explosion the blowout, the force of the oil and gas surging up the well was so powerful it buckled the drill pipe, which is threading through the blowout preventer, and in buckling that drill pipe then made it off center enough so that when the blades closed they only caught the edge of the pipe, so the pipe now is propping open this apparatus that's supposed to be sealing the well, so the blind shear rams don't cut the pipe. They're not closing the well at all. So what they had to look at is, okay, why is this system not more robust why does it not work? I mean, they just need it. They need a better system. They need blowout preventers that actually can work. And it's not only that, but I think in the future, I mean, what they're saying is that they have right now standing by the kind of caps that could go on a well and in a matter of a week or so, shut down and shut in a blown out well. But that's only if you're presented with precisely the kind of blowout situation you had last year. What happens if the blowout preventer is on its side? What happens if the blowout preventer has sunk into the mud? If you have a crater there, if you don't really have a nice, neat well head, what are you going to do then? And the industry needs to investigate that possibility.
I mean, and that's entirely feasible. As that sort of thousands of feet of pipe going up to the rig above, if that collapsed, it could have easily pulled the blowout preventer and the rest of it over, couldn't it?
Yeah, I know. Okay, what if the rig sinks on top of your well, on top of your blowout preventer? So if your blowout preventer is not just sitting there waiting to be dealt with, but you've got a collapsed or a sunken oil rig on top of it. That's a whole different nightmare. And I mean, you can't plan everything around, you know, highly, highly improbable events. I mean, you have to decide what's the most likely risk and so on. But I think that what's clear is that the system wasn't as safe as they thought. They weren't as ready as they thought for dealing with a problem if a problem did arise. Their communications with each other, the different companies involved with these projects, the contractors and the main operator, communications were faulty, that the whole system of having the same person in charge of safety and efficiency, meaning, you know, keeping our costs down, that made no sense because you got a conflict of interest. There's a lot of things that need to be reformed.
Well, one of the things that the you didn't dwell on it too much because you were reporting sort of at the front, but the whole idea of the Mineral Management Service, the regulators being in the pocket of the industry and faxing back, stereotyped approval for stereotyped plans.
Yeah, just they rubber stamped a lot of stuff. They were the regulations.
But they got into trouble if they didn't, of course, didn't they?
Yeah, and just finding good people to be regulators, you know, has been tricky. Right now, they're trying to hire people. They're going to engineering school saying, hey, come work for the new Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement. But a lot of your best engineers probably could make three times as much money.
That's
in the
pretty
industry.
Much like the SEC, where do you want to make money with Goldman Sachs and get huge bonuses, or do you want to work for the government where they stint your pension and give you furloughs?
It's exactly right. So that's a conundrum that's not easily solved. As long as you have profit-making companies that are, leasing these tracks and doing the drilling, you are going to probably have to rely to some extent on the companies to police themselves, you know, to figure out how they can do this safely.
At least hovering over them now is the $40 billion hole in BP's bottom line, so, as an example.
That was the wake-up call, and we would expect that these companies will be far more vigilant now than they were prior to April 20th of 2010, because they saw how bad it could be and how sort of shocking it could be and how unprepared they were for.
Okay, well, Joel, that's all we have time for now. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I've been speaking to Joel Achenbach, whose anniversary hole at the bottom of the sea, the race to kill the BP oil gusher, reminds me of things that I actually didn't know about at the time. Very detailed, yet fascinating, and almost a thriller. Thanks very much, Joe.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.